Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Thursday, March 14th, 2024. I'm your reader, Grace Barter. After just a year on the job, Waterloo Police Chief Joe Leibold announced his retirement Wednesday. His last day is June 21st. Leibold has held the top position since November 2022, but has been with the department since 1990. He was promoted after Joel Fitzgerald, the previous police chief, resigned in August 2022 to take a job in Denver, Colorado. After Fitzgerald's resignation, Leibold was appointed as the interim chief. Being a police officer has grown me as a person and provided me countless opportunities, Leibold said in a news release. I am truly appreciative of the city and everyone who has played a role in my career and personal development. After 8 years at the department, he was promoted to sergeant. He became a lieutenant in 2004 and a captain in 2008. In 2011, he was promoted to Captain of Police Services, and in 2017, his title was changed to Major. He has worked patrol, crime lab, and internal affairs. He is a graduate of the FBI National Academy in Quantico, Virginia. He served in the Army National Guard from 1986 to 1995. According to Courier Archives, he helped create a complaint tracking form, develop the department's use of body and force camera policies, implemented wellness programs for officers, and helped write a successful grant application to start the department's violent crime apprehension team in 2008. Chief Leibold has been an incredible leader for the Waterloo Police Department and has made the city better under his tenure, Waterloo Mayor Quentin Hart said in the release. Not only do I consider him a great police chief, Joe is also a friend. He will be missed, and we appreciate his decades of service to our community. The release states the city is working on finding his replacement, and that plan will be announced later. When searching for Fitzgerald's replacement, the city advertised the job vacancy nationally, and there was a total of 3 applicants, 2 of whom were internal. In 2020, the search was more public, and the candidates held community presentations. From Clarksville, one person is dead following a 2-vehicle crash Monday in rural Clarksville. According to the Iowa State Patrol, Brady Lee Cachette, 31, of Parkersburg, was driving a 2013 Dodge Dart northbound on Quail Avenue around 9:20 p.m. when he allegedly failed to stop at a stop sign and struck the front driver's side of a 2023 Peterbilt semi-tractor trailer traveling westbound on Highway 3. Both vehicles rolled over. The car ended up upright on Highway 3. Cachette was transported, or in the midst of being transported, to Waverly Health Center when he died. The other driver, Mark John Behrens, 57, of Carroll, was injured. The semi rolled into a ditch. He was also transported to Waverly Health Center. The crash remains under investigation. Clarksville and Allison Fire, Emergency Medical Service, and police assisted with the Butler County Sheriff's Office. Old barn off Kimball Avenue in rural Waterloo burned to the ground Tuesday, according to Jared Sadler, assistant chief at Hudson Fire and Rescue. Sadler said the large fire, reported at approximately 2:15 p.m., also spread minimally to the grass and melted the siding on a nearby single-family home at 8738 Kimball Avenue before it was put out. The acreage sits in between Schrock Road and Griffith Road in Orange Township. The barn was used for storage. No animals or people occupied the space, Sadler said. A resident of the home called 911. By the time firefighters arrived, only the frame was standing, said the assistant chief. The cause is believed to be accidental. The embers jumped over the road, leading first responders to block it off. The Hudson firefighters were assisted by Gilbertville Fire and Rescue. A woman allegedly punched a bank employee in the face Monday at a Main Street of Cedar Falls branch during an argument over a notice sent to her. Pamela Lynn Strickler, 64, of Cedar Falls, was arrested and charged for assault causing bodily injury, a serious misdemeanor. The female employee at Farmer State Bank, 515 Main Street, had been walking out on Strickler at the time she reportedly resorted to using her fist, according to court record. The 2:45 p.m. call was originally for trespassing. Strickler eventually left the scene, but was located by officers in the area. They reviewed video from the incident and confirmed statements made by staff and the victim, who advised that her nose and face were sore. Strickler admitted to police she went to the bank to argue with staff about the notice, but denied getting physical with anyone. An explosives investigation led officials to a Waterloo property a few weeks ago. Waterloo Police and its bomb squad assisted the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives in carrying out a search warrant February 29th at 1815 Rush Street, where a single-family home sits on a dead-end road next to a grass field. ATF Public Information Officer Lisa Story said the ongoing investigation, first reported by Waterloo Police Monday, involves explosives, but the public is not in any danger. She could provide little detail about the investigation and the parties believed to be involved, including whether the house was or is the focus. "Just because we were there doesn't mean we won't go back," said Story, who also noted such investigations can lead officials to scan a property quickly and then spread out. The Natatorium project at the new Cedar Falls High School was awarded a $400,000 Community Attraction and Tourism Grant March 7th by the state's Enhance Iowa Board. The Natatorium, an indoor pool complex currently under construction at the school on 27th Street west of Hudson Road, is a collaborative project between the City of Cedar Falls, Cedar Falls Community School District, Blackhawk County, and the public. The project has been spearheaded largely by Jump In, a group of more than 550 community members. The members have advocated for the project and coordinated key fundraisers for the Natatorium. The facility continues a 45-year partnership between the city and school district to provide indoor pools, not only for area students, but for the entire community as well. The state grant is contingent on raising additional funds for the completion of the project. "We are excited to have the opportunity to bring in state dollars to help complete the community natatorium," Laura Lee Redfern, co-chair of Jump In, said in a news release from the city. "This grant is conditional on raising $312,000, and we only have until May 31st, 2024, to raise this amount from individuals and businesses. This is just 1.5% of the total project cost, and we believe our community will rise to the occasion to make sure the natatorium can be completed and become a valuable asset for our city. The community natatorium will be open to the public and replace the outdated existing indoor public pools in Cedar Falls located at Holmes and Pete Junior High, which are almost 50 years old. The new facility utilizes an innovative design to allow for multi-purpose use. The goal is to create one of the best aquatic facilities in Iowa to allow the Cedar Valley a new opportunity to promote health and recreation while also attracting families to aquatic programming and drawing athletic events to the area." According to the release, Iowa Travel Industry Partners Economic Impact Calculator estimates that the economic impact from tourism with new and expanded events will be more than $2.5 million annually. The community natatorium is expected to be completed by early 2025, the release said. The project has a total estimated cost of $21 million and consists of two phases. Phase 1, constructing the shell of the building, is nearing completion. Phase 2, the portion of the project the CAT grant will contribute towards, completes the facility with the competition pool, therapy pool, warm-up cool-down for sporting events, decks, locker rooms, and spectator seating. In addition to the state grant, the Community Natatorium received a Black Hawk County Gaming Association grant of $500,000 in December. To find out about contributing to the Community Natatorium, including a link to donate online, visit thecfpool.com. Deere and Company will lay off 150 production employees at the John Deere Des Moines Works in Ankeny. According to multiple reports, Deere corporate offices in Moline, Illinois, have confirmed 150 workers at the facility were notified Friday about an indefinite layoff effective April and May. Each John Deere factory balances the size of its production workforce with the needs of the individual factory to optimize the workforce at each facility, the company said in a statement. John Deere says its Ankeny facility currently has about 1,700 employees, and 1,136 of them work in production and maintenance roles. Tyson Foods will continue streamlining its operations by closing a pork plant in Iowa that employs 1,200 people and eliminating the largest employer in the town of Perry. The plant closure will be the second major blow to the town this year, coming just 2 months after a 17-year-old student opened a fire at school, killing a sixth grader and his principal, as well as wounding six others. Tyson announced the plant closure Monday. It comes after the company closed several other plants last year and consolidated its corporate operations the year before. Tyson said it will work with state and local officials to help workers who are losing their jobs, but the company didn't say what severance packages it will offer. Tyson did say it will encourage workers to apply for openings at its other plants. 6 years ago, Tyson received $674,000 in incentives from Iowa to help pay for a $44 million upgrade to the Perry plant. Pat Grassley will seek his 10th term in the Iowa House. The Republican House Speaker filed Monday for re-election to the seat representing House District 57, which includes all of Butler County and a western portion of Bremer County, according to a news release. The New Hartford farmer was first elected to the House in 2006 and has served as Speaker since 2019. Grassley said in a statement, "It's an honor to represent House District 57. In my time in the State House, I have built a reputation of being responsible with your tax dollars and a strong advocate for rural Iowa. I'm asking for another term to continue to be your voice in Des Moines and deliver on your priorities. The primary election is June 4th. His current 2-year term expires January 12th. Iowa's U.S. Senator Joni Ernst will run for the number 3 position in Senate Republican leadership, challenging Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas for the position. Ernst's bid for Republican conference chair was first reported in Politico on Monday. Ernst's office confirmed her candidacy to the Courier Des Moines Bureau. In an interview with Politico on Sunday, Ernst depicted herself as an outsider as she seeks to advance in Senate leadership. Ernst holds the number 4 position in the Senate GOP leadership as chair of the Republican Policy Committee. The bid comes amid a shakeup after Senator Mitch McConnell, a Republican from Kentucky, announced he was stepping down from leadership after 17 years at the helm of the caucus. Senator John Cornyn of Texas and Republican Whip John Thune of South Dakota have announced their candidacies for the top Senate GOP position. The current Republican Conference Chair, Senator John Barrasso of Wyoming, will run for Republican Whip, opening up the number 3 position. Cotton, who does not hold a leadership position, announced his candidacy last week. Now, in her second term in the Senate, Ernst was first elected to leadership as vice chair of the Senate GOP conference in 2018. In 2022, she became the chair of the Republican Policy Committee and is the highest-ranking Republican woman in the Senate. Ernst told Politico she would look critically at legislation that comes before the caucus and take on difficult issues. Bands and large groups interested in competing in the Iowa Irish Fest's Battle of the Irish Bands contest must sign up by midnight Sunday. Interested groups and individuals are asked to submit a video submission of 2 songs they are performing. Entries should include a personal introduction to the band and why the band is passionate about Irish music. To participate, download the video entry onto a portable drive and mail it to Cedar Valley Irish Cultural Association, Battle of the Bands, 315 East 5th Street, Waterloo, 50703. Or submit an online video link via email to entertainment@iowairishfest.com. Submissions will be judged by members of the Iowa Irish Fest Committee. Entry scores will be based on musical ability and stage presence. 4 top entries will be selected April 3rd for the final battle. Finalists will perform August 1st on the festival grounds and the winner announced. The winner will receive a $500 cash prize and will perform during Iowa Irish Fest, August 2nd through 4th in downtown Waterloo. Black Hawk County is reminding people planning to apply a dust suppressant to a gravel road to contact and sign up with an approved contractor before April 15th. Residents are responsible for all payments to the contractor, but are not charged for the permit. For a list of contractors and reminders about the county's dust control policy, go online to blackhawkcounty.iowa.gov/222/dust-control. Call 319-833-3008 with any questions. The Salvation Army of Waterloo Cedar Falls is urgently hiring for all emergency shelter positions. The shelters are currently running as normal, and leadership will make up every effort to keep services as routine as possible for shelter residents. Should any temporary changes be necessary, the community will be notified. Positions including Housing Services Coordinator, Shelter Monitor Manager, Shelter Monitor, and Shelter Monitor Assistant. For more information or to apply, visit Indeed.com or the Salvation Army's careers page at bit.ly/49FIEYS. A bill that's currently in the Iowa legislature would limit legal cannabis product potency. Hemp-derived cannabis products in Iowa would be significantly limited in their potency under a bill Iowa House lawmakers passed on Tuesday. The bill would place several regulations on consumable hemp products, which were legalized under the 2018 Farm Bill and later the Iowa Hemp Act. The laws allow for the sale of hemp products that contain less than 0.3% THC by weight. THC is the main chemical in marijuana that causes the high. While the law was intended to address low-potency CBD sales, it also legalized the sale of hemp-derived THC products that have a similar psychoactive effect to traditional marijuana. House File 2605, amended on the floor before passage on Tuesday, would set a limit of 4 milligrams of THC per serving and 10 milligrams per package on consumable hemp products sold in the state. While there is no limit on the concentration of hemp-derived THC products sold in the state, they generally range from 5 to 10 milligrams per serving. The bill would ban the use of consumable hemp, including non-psychoactive CBD, by minors and ban the sale of the products to minors. It would also ban the sale of synthetic THC and require a warning label to be attached to consumable hemp products. It would also create criminal and civil penalties for selling consumable hemp products without first registering with the state. The State Department of Health and Human Services would be allowed to confiscate products from retailers found to be in violation of the law. The bill passed the House 79-16. 4 Republicans and 12 Democrats voted against the proposal. A companion bill has passed a committee in the Senate and is eligible for consideration by the full chamber. A retail industry around THC products derived from legal hemp has burgeoned over the last 6 years since the federal and state hemp laws were passed. The products are available for sale in stores across the state, and companies like Iowa's Climbing Kites are manufacturing their own THC drinks. Representative Steve Holt, a Republican from Denison who managed the bill, said lawmakers never intended to legalize intoxicating products when they passed the Iowa Hemp Act. He said the industry is a wild west without regulations, and the bill would close unintended loopholes. He said, in the legislation we passed, there were no provisions for age requirements, precisely because we did not believe or have any idea that there would be a need, since we had limited the THC. We were not approving THC to be used in intoxicating products, or we would have had age restrictions. Pointing to studies on youth use of cannabis, Holt argued that the bill would protect the health of Iowans. Representative Bob Kresig, a Democrat from Cedar Falls who opposed the bill, said during floor debate Tuesday that the bill would kneecap Iowa's hemp industry and lead to businesses to close and Iowans to lose jobs. He also argued that some people use CBD and other products for medical purposes outside the state's medical cannabis program. Kresig said he supports limiting the sale of the products to minors, but would like to have seen a higher THC limit on products. The U.S. House on Wednesday passed a bill that would lead to a nationwide ban of the popular video app TikTok if its Chinese-based owner doesn't sell, as lawmakers acted on concerns that the company's current ownership structure is a national security threat. The bill, passed by a vote of 352-65, now goes to the Senate, where its prospects are unclear. Representative Ashley Hinson, Republican from Iowa, co-led the legislation which would force the popular social media platform to divest its U.S. subsidiary to avoid the ban. The bill would prevent App Store availability or web hosting services in the U.S. for applications like TikTok unless the application severs ties to entities like ByteDance that are subject to the control of the Chinese Communist Party. The bill also gives the president the authority to deny other social media apps owned and operated by foreign adversaries access to U.S. users unless they sever ties to their foreign owners. Hinson said backers said the goal is not a ban, but a forced divestiture by ByteDance because of concerns that top Chinese government officials have access to American users' data and could use such access to manipulate TikTok's algorithm to sow divisiveness and discord, poison U.S. public opinion, and suppress content critical of Beijing, as well as compromise the cell phones of millions of American users. TikTok just needs to cut ties with CCP or they will lose American users, said Hinson, who sits on the House Select Committee on the Chinese Communist Party that originated the bill. TikTok has about 170 million American users. ByteDance Technology is a Chinese internet technology company headquartered in Beijing. It is operating in the United States through a holding company, ByteDance Limited, the parent company of TikTok. The legislation moved forward despite opposition by former President Donald Trump. Trump, who tried to ban TikTok as president, posted on Truth Social that getting rid of TikTok would only help Facebook, which he called a true enemy of the people. The presumptive 2024 Republican presidential nominee launched Truth Social to rival Facebook and Twitter after Trump was banned from the sites. Trump personally could potentially profit if the company goes public as planned this year, CQ Roll Call reported. Trump also recently met with billionaire hedge fund investor Jeff Yass, whose fund has a more than $30 billion stake in TikTok, parent dance ByteDance, the Wall Street Journal reported. Asked by CNBC Monday if he had changed his views on TikTok after meeting with Yass, Trump said TikTok never came up during their meeting. Asked by CNBC Monday if he had changed his views on TikTok after meeting with Yass, Trump said TikTok never came up. Asked about Trump's opposition ahead of the vote, Hinson said her mind was made up on the bill, which she said has bipartisan support in Congress. I don't think any outside influence is going to change my mind here, she said, and if TikTok does not cut ties with the CCP, it should not be able to operate in the U.S., plain and simple. This is a national security issue. Lawmakers on Tuesday received a classified briefing with U.S. intelligence and law enforcement officials that led them to fast-track the measure. I saw many dozen other members of Congress on both sides of the aisle at that meeting, Hinson said, and at least in my mind it has flagged a very important discussion about the role social media is playing in our country right now and the damaging impact it has on our kids. I think that is a larger conversation we need to have after we first make sure we get TikTok to divest ties from the CCP. Some free speech advocates say the measure violates First Amendment protections, but backers contend the bill is an appropriate step to protect America's national security interests and only applies to applications controlled by a foreign adversary. Iowa's members of Congress received numerous calls last Thursday from TikTok users who were prompted by the app to call their representatives in response to the House legislation targeting the social media platform. The aggressive move by the wildly popular social media app came the same day the House Energy and Commerce Committee unanimously passed the bill that would ban TikTok from U.S. app stores unless its Chinese parent company sells the app. President Joe Biden said Friday he would sign the bill if it reaches his desk. TikTok users last Thursday were greeted with a message warning that Congress is planning a total ban of TikTok and prompting them to call their congressional representative. At one point that day, Hinson was personally answering phones and explaining to callers the intent of the bill. Hinson told reporters Tuesday it was nonstop. We were getting a barrage of phone calls. The Marion Republican accused TikTok of lying to and manipulating its users, many of whom are U.S. youth. It is so unacceptable, and TikTok's disregard to kids' mental health was really on full display, Hinson said, and quite frankly, they proved our point for us. Hinson asked, what if TikTok had taken the same tactic ahead of a U.S. election, falsely saying polls were closed on Election Day, or whatever message the CCP wanted them to disseminate to their captive American audience, she said. Hinson said she's also fielded calls from parents ticked off at TikTok. This is about protecting our kids, she said. You want to infuriate parents across the country? Feed their kids a lie and manipulate them as a political pawn. House passage of the bill is only the first step. The Senate would also need to pass the measure for it to become law, and lawmakers in that chamber indicated it would undergo a thorough review. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, a Democrat from New York, said he'll have to consult with relevant committee chairs to determine the bill's path. You are listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Thursday, March 14, 2024, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Wilma N. Thornton Johnson, 90, a resident at Friendship Village, Wellspring Living, passed away Tuesday, March 5th. Wilma was born on January 5, 1934, in Des Moines, Iowa. She grew up in Des Moines, where she graduated from East High School. After graduation, she met Roy Milton Hennick, and the two were married. Wilma N. Thornton Johnson, 90, a resident at Friendship Village Wellspring Living, passed away Tuesday, March 5th. Wilma was born on January 5, 1934, in Des Moines, Iowa. She grew up in Des Moines, where she graduated from East High School. She began her working career at Northwestern Bell, also known as U.S. West, where she worked as a telephone operator. In 1960, Wilma moved to Waterloo, and in 1969, she began working at Montgomery Ward. She later returned to Northwestern Bell, where she earned an early retirement. Wilma had been a member of Central Christian Church in Waterloo. She was also a member of the Telephone Pioneers International Chapter, PEO Sisterhood Chapter, CWA Eastern Iowa Retired Members. In her earlier years, she volunteered for the Kittrell Elementary PTA. Funeral service will be held Monday, March 18th at 10:30 a.m. at Central Christian Church in Waterloo. A visitation will take place 1 hour prior. Burial will follow services at the Waterloo Memorial Park Cemetery. Memorials may be directed to the Northeast Iowa Food Bank or the church. Judy Birch Staduhar, 84, of Monterey, California, passed away March 6th. After graduating from Cedar Falls High School, she attended Drake University in Des Moines, graduating with a Bachelor of Arts in Education in 1961. Judy taught in elementary schools in the Chicago suburbs until 1967, when she married Wayne Wall and moved to Sheboygan, Wisconsin, where they adopted a son, Fred. After a divorce, Judy and Fred moved to Plano, Texas, where she opened and managed the Epicurean, a gourmet cookware boutique that expanded to several cookware shops around Dallas, eventually marrying a longtime friend, Frank Staduhar. After Judy sold her business in Texas, she and Frank moved to the Monterey Peninsula in California, settling in Pacific Grove. After running a successful mail order business for 2 years, they became prominent realtors in the Monterey area for several years. Judy retired in 2014 after Frank's passing, eventually leaving Pacific Grove for Scottsdale, Arizona in 2021 to reside in a senior care community. Shirley May Penhoff Scarless, 89, of Waterloo, died Monday, March 11th, while a resident at Wellspring Living Health Center at Friendship Village. She was born May 26, 1934, in Mason City. Shirley graduated from Garner High School in 1952 and married George Scarless on January 30th, 1965, in Owatonna, Minnesota. As a young woman, Shirley managed a radio station in Mason City, and as a reporter for that station, was one of the first people on the scene of the Buddy Holly plane crash. She also flew with the Blue Angels in 1960. Shirley was a member of Daughters of the American Revolution and St. Demetrius Greek Orthodox Church. Funeral service for Shirley will be Friday, March 15th at St. Demetrius Greek Orthodox Church, 613 West 4th Street, Waterloo, with burial to follow at Waterloo Memorial Park Cemetery. The family will greet friends Thursday, March 14th from 5 to 7 p.m. with a Trisagion service at 7 p.m. at Locke on 4th Street, Waterloo. Joan Marie Crawford, 77, of Allison, passed away March 9th. Visitation is Monday, March 18th from 4 to 7 p.m. at Parrott and Wood Funeral Home, 965 Home Plaza, Waterloo. Funeral services will be Tuesday, March 19th at 10:30 a.m. at Open Bible Church, 928 Jefferson Street, Waterloo. John Jack Sloan, 81, formerly of Hiawatha, passed away Friday, March 8th. Funeral services will be held Friday, March 15th at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Cedar Rapids. Visitation will be from 1 to 2 p.m. with the service to begin at 2 p.m. at the funeral home. And now we head off to sports. Imagine Iowa star Caitlin Clark playing a basketball game where the rules allowed her just 2 dribbles before she had to pass or shoot, and it was illegal for her to cross the half-court line. For most of the 20th century, this was girls' basketball in Clark's native state. The game was 6-on-6, with 3 girls on one side of the court playing defense and 3 on the other side playing offense. The rules might seem archaic now, if not blatantly sexist, but it was popular. Girls' high school games filled gyms to capacity, and many towns and state tournament tickets were resold at a premium, with the finals televised in 9 Midwestern states. Sometimes it was so loud in our little gym that we couldn't even hear the coach when we were in a huddle, said Nancy Schmitz, who starred at Elkhorn Kimbleton in the 1960s when her name was Nancy Wolken. It was really dynamic, a lot of screaming and hollering, and we all loved to play. I should have studied more, but I loved to play. Every game the gym was full. Iowa coach Lisa Bluter, associate head coach Jan Jensen, and assistant Jenny Fitzgerald grew up playing 6-on-6, and Clark regularly gives a nod to her forebears in the sports. She says, "When I hear from a lot of people that played basketball, whether it was 6-on-6, however many years ago, I think they're blown away at where women's basketball is now and the platform we get to play on. That doesn't come if it's not for the people who came before us." With her long-range shooting and nifty passing, Clark has become the face of women's basketball and is among the most popular athletes in the United States. She has averaged 31.9 points per game this season and passed Pete Maravich as the NCAA Division I all-time leading scorer. Jensen, one of the state's all-time high school greats, said Clark would have been just as formidable in the 6-girl game. Those shots from the perimeter and thread the needle passes would have been part of her game. Her snaking drives to the basket, not so much because of the two dribble limit. Iowa high schools could choose to play 5-on-5 beginning in 1984, but many small schools kept playing 6-on-6 until 1993, only 23 years before Clark's freshman year at Dowling Catholic in West Des Moines. Near the end of the 6-on-6 era, Columbus Catholic in Waterloo fielded a string of strong teams. The Sailors qualified for the 6-on-6 state tournament in 1982, 83, and 85, losing to Fort Dodge 88-81 in the 6-on-6 state final in 1985. In 1986, Columbus qualified for the 5-player state tournament. Chuck Offenberger, a retired Des Moines Register columnist and now author who writes about Iowa news and culture on Offenberger.com, said immigrants from Northern Europe who settled in the state in the 19th century believed strongly in physical fitness for both sexes. Boys and girls worked alongside each other in the farm fields, and basketball was seen as a suitable competitive outlet for all. The caveat was that the sport was considered too strenuous for girls of that era, so special rules were made. Even at that, a federal study on physical education in the 1920s put the kibosh on girls' basketball in some areas of the state. The conclusion was that girls should not be involved in interscholastic and competitive athletics because it could affect their birthing capacity in later life, Offenberger said. The larger schools in the larger towns and cities just bought that lock, stock, and barrel, and they ended their programs. In 6-on-6, players on the defensive side did not inbound the ball and bring it up after the opponent made a basket. Instead, the referee would throw the ball to half court, where his partner would give it to a forward to initiate the next sequence of play. Games could be fast-paced and high-scoring. Jensen averaged just under 66 points per game as a senior in 1987 at Elkhorn Kimbleton, and she went on to become a national scoring leader and All-American at Drake. Jensen's grandmother, Dorcas Anderson, was MVP of the 1921 state tournament for Audubon and nicknamed Lottie because she scored a lot of points. In 1926, Irene Silka of Maynard became the first girl to score 100 points in a game. Denise Long of Union Witten was so dominant she was drafted by the San Francisco Warriors in 1969 as a publicity stunt. Lynn Lorenzen of Ventura set the still-standing national career scoring record in 1987 with an astonishing 6,736 points. She led Ventura to an undefeated season, winning the state championship over Southeast Polk that year. Schmitz, who lives in La Vista, Nebraska, preceded Jensen by 20 years at Elkhorn and played on the 1967 team that was the school's first to reach the state tournament. Her black and orange number 35 jersey, white Converse All-Star canvas high tops, and a scrapbook are among the memorabilia she kept from her playing days. I was disappointed and a little sad when Iowa girls' 6-on-6 basketball came to an end, she said. The game had a uniqueness all its own. Many states didn't offer girls' sports until the 1970s. By then, girls' basketball had been ingrained in Iowa's culture for more than half a century. So, Schmitz said she and her teammates didn't realize they were ahead of their times. She said, I felt very blessed to have competed during that era, and many of my teammates and I have known each other since grade school and still maintain those friendships and love to reminisce about our days together on the court. From Waverly, Brittany Young looked at her questioner incredulously. After arriving back from Rhode Island Sunday, less than 24 hours after Young helped her Wartburg College women's basketball team qualify for the Division III Final Four with a 68-58 victory over Washington and Lee, Young ran into a fan. Here is how Young described the conversation. She asked, "Can you believe you are going to the Final Four?" Young related. "Yeah, I can," Young answered her fan back. The confident answer from the senior starter from Waverly is easily quantifiable. Young knows how much work and dedication has gone into achieving the Knights' third Final Four appearance in program history. Sixth-ranked Wartburg will play number 14 Smith College tonight in Columbus, Ohio at 4 p.m. in the first national semifinal. The national championship game is set for Saturday. The Knights also qualified for the Final Four in 2016 and 2018 and made the Sweet 16 a year ago. Smith College was a Final Four participant in 2023. Wartburg has lost both of its prior national semifinal games in 2016 to Tufts University and to Bowdoin College in 2018. Knight head coach Bob Amesbury calls this team, which has seven seniors, a special group, a group he says in his 30-year career that has more trust in each other than any other team he has coached. Amesbury also called this squad one of the most selfless teams he's had, saying on any given night a different player steps up and leads. Wartburg has five players who average more than eight a game, with Murphy's 14.8 points and 6.1 rebounds a game leading the team. Guard Sarah Faber, at 12 points a game, is the only other player who averages in double figures. Smith College advanced to the semifinals with wins over UW Oshkosh, 61-59, and Bowdoin College, 52-47, in the Elite Eight. New York University, which is riding a 29-game win streak, will play Transylvania in the other semifinal at 6:30 p.m. Transylvania, last year's national champions, is riding a 64-game win streak. Smith College is led by a pair of 14-point-a-game scorers, forward Jesse Ruffner and guard Allie Yamada. Jaden Murphy will be the fourth Murphy sister to play in a Final Four game for the Knights. Her older sisters, Megan and Miranda, played for Coach Amesbury on the 2016 squad, and then Megan, Miranda, and Riley all played in the 2018 game. Their father, Mike, was the 1989 Iowa Conference Men's Basketball Player of the Year, and he played on a Knights team that played in the Men's Elite Eight in 1987. Amesbury said of the Murphys, "They are really talented, for one. When this thing started with Mike Murphy, who went to the Elite Eight over in North Park, I think it was Megan and Miranda's senior year in 2018, and we went to North Park, and it brought back a bunch of memories for him. So there were jokes about the girls going farther than him. It's a really cool story. Megan, Miranda, and Riley went to the Final Four, which was one-upping Mike, and we are hoping Jaden can one-up the rest of them." Also from Wartburg College, the wrestling coach, Eric Keller, did not write a new book on the advice he was giving his team in the days leading up to the NCAA Division III Wrestling Championships at the La Crosse Center set for this Friday and Saturday. He gave them one directive as the Knights chase their 16th national title over the 2 days and try and improve on its national runner-up finish in 2023. "Every guy wrestling at their full God-given potential. That is all we ever ask of them," Keller answered on what needs to happen. Wartburg qualified seven wrestlers for the championships, including defending national champion Zane Mulder at 174 and Masama Endine at 197. Additionally, Joe Pins, seated second at 133, is a two-time All-American who is motivated to return to the podium after missing a spot on it in 2023. The Knights' other four qualifiers are making their first NCAA appearance: Kyler Romero, seated third at 141, Charlie Dogen, seated 6th at 149, Casey Ross, seated 3rd at 184, and unseated Mitch Williamson, a former NJCAA national champion who is unseated at 285. Defending champion Augsburg University qualified all 10 of its starters, and 8 of them are seated. Baldwin Wallace has 8 qualifiers, while Johnson and Wales joins Wartburg with 7. Augsburg blew the field away last year, winning by 34.5 points, but 2nd through 6th was separated by 14 points, and 2nd through 5th was separated by 5.5 points. It is a tournament full of firepower, as national champions return at 125, 133, 141, 149, 157, 174, and 197. And national runners-up are back at 125, 165, 174, and 197. 6 of Wartburg's 7 wrestlers are seated, and 4 of them 3rd or better. Pigtail matches begin at 11 a.m. Friday, and the tournament will roll into the first round and consolation first round during the opening session. Championship quarterfinals will also take place Saturday at 6 p.m. The national championship matches are slated for 7 p.m. on Saturday. Fun! It is what March is about. Northern Iowa head coach's women's basketball coach Tanya Warren does not want the Panthers to make any radical changes when it comes time for tip-off at the Missouri Valley Conference Tournament, Hoops in the Heartland, in Moline, Illinois, on Friday. It does not matter whether their opponent at 2:30 p.m. in Vibrant Arena is 5th-seeded Illinois State or 12th-seeded Evansville. Warren said, "We have to continue to play you and I basketball and be intentional on both sides of the basketball. We want to continue to be who we are and what we do and just be intentional." With 4 straight wins to round out the regular season, the Panthers climbed above 500 for the first time since winning its season-opening matchup against Green Bay Phoenix, who won the 2023-24 Horizon League Tournament Championship on Tuesday. Sitting at 15-14 and in 4th place in the MVC heading into Hoops in the Heartland, Warren did not let the chance to praise her resilient team pass her by. Regardless of how the 23-24 season ends, it will go down as one marred by injury for the Panthers, who saw each of its top 3 returning scorers, Emerson Green, Grace Buffelli, and Maya McDermott, miss time. Buffelli, the MVC preseason player of the year, and McDermott managed to recover mid-season and return to the floor, while Green suffered a season-ending injury at the beginning of February. To Warren, the ability to take on those challenges and emerge on the other side with a first-round bye in Hoops in the Heartland and a winning record speaks to the resolve of her team, which started 23-24 as the preseason favorite to claim the conference crown. Warren said, "Starting 1-9 and being able to finish 15-14 gives you a lot of confidence. The one word I would use to describe this team is persevere. They have persevered every single challenge that has been thrown at them, and they have handled it well." Winners of 6 of their last 7 games, the Panthers can still live up to their preseason billing. Their lone loss, a 79-77 slugfest game against MVC regular season champion Drake in Des Moines, it is a fact Warren said she points to motivate her team ahead of Friday. According to Warren, a different player stepped up in different ways in each game as the battle-tested Panthers surged to the finish line. With a first-round bye, Warren said the Panthers will take advantage of the extra day's rest with a few dinged-up players. "You and I will also follow a similar itinerary for their, hopefully, extended stay in Moline for the conference tournament. The 17-year head coach joked, however, that they will vary their plans a little in hopes of securing a different result after coming up short of conference tournament championship goals in recent years. Once they take the floor in Moline, Warren said it is a matter of playing UNI basketball, controlling what you can control, having a short memory, and playing with resilience, and having fun. Broadcast coverage of the Panthers' quarterfinal matchup on Friday will be provided by ESPN Plus and the Panther Sports Radio Network on 106.5 FM, Corn Country, KCFI. And that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Thursday, March 14th, 2024. I'm your reader, Grace Barter. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.
Roxanne Watson is on a mission.
Hello, how are you doing today?
She wants more people to register as organ, eye, and tissue donors.
Are you an organ donor?
Yes, I am.
Yay!
My goal is to sign up the most people in the United States.
What drives her? Roxanne's own life was saved through the gift of a heart transplant, made possible by an organ donor.
I decided that day that I was going to devote myself to the cause of organ donation and signing people up and honoring my donor by doing that.
Now she's back to health, and she's a powerful force helping to save lives every day through her work. Imagine what you can make possible by leaving behind the gift of life.
8 people can be helped with the major organs, and up to 50 people can be helped with a little bit of everything. And when you think about it that way, that you could help that many people, it's amazing, it really is.
Learn more and sign up as an organ, eye, and tissue donor. Go to organdonor.gov. A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Health Resources and Services Administration.